We are recording this podcast on the lands of the Wurundjeri people of the Kulin Nation. We wish to pay our respects to elders past, present and emerging, and extend our respects to any Aboriginal or Torres Strait Islander people who may be listening.
Hi everybody, I'm Priscilla.
And I'm Elise.
Welcome to Novel Feelings, where two psychologists take a deep dive into fiction novels.
And as usual, don't forget to keep up to date with us by subscribing on your favourite podcast app or following us via @novel_feelings on Instagram and Twitter.
Following us on social media is actually kind of important, I would say, this time around, if you would like to keep up with us, because there may be some things in the works.
There might be season 3 happening. Yeah, we've taken a long break.
We have, yes.
It's been a long time since we've posted any kind of audio review. We're still doing blog reviews and briefer reviews on our Instagram, but look, we've missed it. We've missed doing the full in-depth reviews. Yeah. And we have actually read or had, you know, quite a number of books on our TBR lists that have mental health content or have psychological issues and so on that we just want to talk about. So there might be some episodes incoming.
Yeah. So our social is once again @novel_feelings on Instagram and Twitter. So maybe stay tuned.
Yeah, there are some exciting things around the corner. Yeah. But today we are here for another interview, our third and most likely final one for 2022. The opportunity to interview another author came across our inbox recently, and we were a bit excited by this one.
Just a little bit.
Today we are interviewing Nina Kenwood, the author of It Sounded Better in My Head and the most recent Unnecessary Drama.
Nina Kenwood is an award-winning author living in Melbourne. Her debut YA novel, It Sounded Better in My Head, won the Text Prize and was a finalist for the American Library Association's William C. Morris Award, a CBCA notable book, as well as being shortlisted for the New South Wales Premier's Literary Awards.
It's done well.
It's done very well. It Sounded Better in My Head has been published in 6 languages and is optioned for film. That is news to me. That's exciting.
Yeah, I found that on the website. It's a bit, some good news. But today we are focusing on Nina's newly released book called Unnecessary Drama. A bit about the book. So 18-year-old Brooke is the kind of friend who not only remembers everyone's birthdays, but also organizes the group present, pays for it, and politely chases others for their share. Relatable. She's the helper, the doer, the guarder of drinks, the minder of bags, the maker of spreadsheets. She's the responsible one who always follows the rules, and she plans to keep it that way during her first year of university. Her new share house is rules light, but no unnecessary drama means no fights, tension, or romance between housemates. When one of her housemates turns out to be Jessie, her high school nemesis, Brooke is nervously confident that she can handle it. They'll simply silently endure living together and stay out of each other's way. But it turns out Jessie isn't so easy to ignore.
Ah, rom-com. Love it. Before we get started on the interview, just a disclaimer, as always, that we are trained psychologists, but this podcast should not be taken as direct therapeutic advice. Please consult a professional for more specific and tailored advice. The first half of this interview is spoiler-free, but the second half contains, well, is it minor or is it like just spoilers in general? The second half contains spoilers for Unnecessary Drama as we dig into the mental health content and what happens in the second half in the book. Also, we'll just flag that this interview has been edited for length.
And a couple of quick content notes. So please know that today we're talking about topics such as anxiety and catastrophizing, difficult family relationships and parental neglect, and a little bit about alcohol use and misuse.
Yes, so let's get into it.
So, Nina, thank you so much for joining us today. We're really looking forward to having a chat about Unnecessary Drama and asking all of the detailed questions about the mental health rep in this book.
Thank you for having me.
First off, how does it feel to be releasing your second novel? How does it compare to the first one?
It's a lot It's a lot calmer. The first one, you're so, well, I'm an extremely anxious person. I think you can probably tell that from my books. Yeah, the first book that you, well, when I released my first book, I had just had my first child like 3 months earlier. So I was in, I was sleep deprived. I was, you know, I had a new baby. I had all of those emotions going on. So it was a lot. I was just in a very overwhelmed place. And so that was a lot. So this time, the second book has felt a lot calmer, but I think a lot of that is to do with not being completely sleep deprived and having a newborn.
Yeah, that's great. I'm glad you have a calmer experience this time around. Yeah.
I imagine even without the experience of having the newborn, there's probably that, you know, excitement and anxiety that can come out with having the first release too.
Exactly. It was because I had never published anything before. So it was like going from 0 to 100 in terms of making yourself vulnerable to so many people through your work. And I had no idea what that would feel like to, you know, there's a lot of yourself, especially with my first book that, well, both books, there's a lot of my sort of stuff in there, but it's such a vulnerable feeling putting a book out into the world. And I had no idea what to expect. So now I'm much more emotionally ready for that vulnerability.
Yeah. Are there things that you're doing differently this time around to, I suppose, prepare or get through?
Not so much. I think it's just being more comfortable talking about yourself, being more comfortable talking about the work, being less afraid of bad reviews. I've read a lot of reviews, a lot of, you know, my first book has a lot of Goodreads reviews, and you know, there's the whole range in there. And so I am the kind of author, for better or worse, who reads their reviews. So you build up some barriers around reading negative things, and that's all fine now. So I'm a lot more, stronger around the whole process. I feel a lot more, I know how to protect myself and where I need to protect myself.
Yeah, that's great.
Have you been reading the reviews of the new book?
Yes. Yep. I read all the reviews, which is, you know what, I think anyone that takes the time to read your book and write about it, that's meaningful. It's hard for me to really get mad at a bad review, especially a Goodreads review, where it's like they're not being paid. They have read the book off their, you know, own. They've bought the book. They've read the book. I'm just grateful to have people engaging with the work, really.
Yeah, I think it's also just an important reminder to people on Goodreads that sometimes the author does read your review. So kindness goes a long way.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, but, you know, it's not an author space. It's a reader space, and I respect that, and I would never respond to any review. And it is interesting. I kind of love seeing what people respond to, and even if it's a negative response, it's interesting to see what people think and where, you know, what works, what doesn't. And often it's the same thing. Someone will love and someone will hate. So you're never going to please anyone.
Well, as we know, in the words of Taylor Swift, hate is going to hate, 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 hate. Very topical this week. Midnight's coming out.
Yes.
Well, I know that both of us really related to a lot of Brooke's inner world, in particular her anxiety. She was a very strong protagonist, and one that I'm sure a lot of readers are going to, you know, be able to step into the shoes of very easily. Can you tell us about how you conceptualize Brooke's inner world and her thought processes?
I started writing it in 2020, which was a very, very anxious year for everyone, and for people who are already anxious like me. That was just a very heightened time. I had a one-year-old. I was returning to work from maternity leave. I was trying to write. I was trying to work. I was trying to parent, and I was trying to exist in the world of COVID. And all of that anxiety sort of came out on the page through Brooke. Not that COVID is not in the book. Brooke's anxieties are obviously the anxieties of an 18-year-old, not a 30-something-year-old mother, but while we were worrying about completely different things, we were kind of vibrating at the same frequency, I like to think. So it was very easy to tap into the mind of an anxious character when I was in that place. And yeah, so it was, that's how I start writing. I always start with getting into my character's head and figuring out who they are and all of the sort of, all of the parts of Brooke and her inner dialogue. My books are very voice driven. So it's really finding that character voice, really knowing that character before I start on the plot or any of the other elements of the book. And that's what I really focused on. And that's where I found sort of Brooke's, all of Brooke's components, including her anxieties.
Yeah, what you mentioned about your books being really voice driven, that's what I found having read both It Sounded Better in My Head and Unnecessary Drama. And I really love that about your writings. It feels like I'm really living in the character's head. Though I suppose, you know, with Brooke being such an anxious character, sometimes the overthinking or the catastrophizing is often really strong, that I actually get a touch of secondhand anxiety myself. What was it like for you writing those moments?
I think that kind of thought process comes to me very naturally. So it's not, and often people will say, oh gosh, I felt so anxious reading that, which makes me feel bad because I don't want anyone to feel anxious. And it often surprises me because sometimes her thought processes are such a natural part of my own thought process that I don't even register it as making it you anxious. Mm-hmm. And I'm also really trying to make it funny as well and engaging and not too, I want my book to be a joyful experience. It's Unnecessary Drama, especially, is a rom-com at its heart. So it's like balancing the dark and the light and what kind of humor can we draw out of that overanalyzing, very anxious, very sort of neurotic space that she's in.
Yeah, no, I don't think your book's dark at all. I think it is. There is quite a lot of joy, and there was multiple times actually where I actually laughed out loud.
Same.
And you're right. I think even when she's really, you know, perfectionist and really in her head, there were moments where that was actually quite funny. I think there was one stage where she was talking about binders or like sitting in front of the TV with all the color-coded post-it notes or something like that. And I was like, that's my ideal Friday night as well. I would like to be doing that.
Yeah, the relatability is big on, I want, yes, people to feel seen and to relate to her and to, I guess, understand her and where that, all of her anxieties are coming from.
I know personally the elements of Brooke's anxiety that I really related to were the sort of performative and perfectionistic side of things. So, you know, being the high achiever, being the sort of person who's really holds themselves to a high standard and is really pushing for more and more and more. And also the mum friend side of things. That was something I related to a lot as well, being seen as the responsible one and the caring one. But, you know, where that comes from is often not a very healthy space. So I think I really appreciated that and seeing, you know, seeing where Brooke's anxiety was coming from with her family situation too was something that I thought was, yeah, really well done.
Thank you. Yes. You see a lot of firstborn, older sister who have to take on that responsible role. But I wanted to explore the idea of being the younger sister and feeling like you have to look after your older sibling and that kind of dynamic, which is a different one again. And yeah, to explore that feeling of responsibility and worrying about wanting to be in control all the time and worrying about not being able to control the out of control people in your life, I guess.
Absolutely. Yeah. And it made me think of the term high functioning anxiety, which is not, you know, a clinical term. It's not a diagnosis that we would give as psychologists or anything along those lines. But that idea that someone's inner world can be really, really intense and difficult to manage and has a lot of impacts. But on the surface, they might seem to be doing okay. They might have their quirks. They might have elements of their personality that seem grating or frustrating at times. But, you know, they can still make it to work or to uni or so on. They can still have some friendships. They can still get, you know, do their housework and get through their day-to-day life, but inner turmoil, a lot of inner turmoil is going on.
And sometimes that anxiety is actually driving, like, is driving the achievement. So you look like you are such a high achiever and you are so productive, but it's because you're afraid to not be.
A kind of worst case scenario planning, yes. I think. Yeah. Really appreciated seeing that in Brooke. And I know for me, it felt, reading Brooke's dialogue felt a bit like stepping into my 18 or 19 year old self a little bit at times, not just for the sort of anxiety thoughts and that transition, but also just the share house living situation. So as someone who has lived in her fair share of really shitty share houses over time, there are a few elements that really could have come from my own story. So things like being uncomfortable with how housemates have organized the dishes and thinking they were illogical the way things have been put away and that causing conflict. Being the only sober one at a house party and having to look after everyone else. And even finding a mouse in my room, that happened once. That was not a fun time and had to bring in my housemate's cat to try to at least get it in a corner so we could get it out of the room. I was just wondering if any of these were inspired by real life events.
Yes, definitely. As well as my own experience and sort of, you know, throughout my whole 20s, seeing friends in share houses as well. I've sort of collected a lot of stories and experiences over time. The mouse came from actually as I was writing the book, I was living in an old house and we had a mouse. And it was of great stress to me. And so that got put in the book. So I was living that as I was writing it. So that's where the mouse came from. But yes, it's a share house is kind of the perfect place to put someone who is very anxious and controlling and likes things done their own way and likes to be tidy and likes to be clean and organized and have systems, because it gives them, it's their worst nightmare. It's kind of, it gives, there's a lot of good content that can come out of that.
Yeah. So that leads in nicely to one of our questions, which is that both It Sounded Better in My Head and Unnecessary Drama are about this sort of transition period between year 12 and whatever comes next. I was wondering what draws you to this time period in particular in a character's life?
I just really like exploring that time where you are, you're suddenly an adult, but you don't feel like an adult at all. And school is behind you. And it feels like you've got the whole rest of your life sort of coming at you, and it's an exciting time to explore as a writer, because there's so much turmoil, there's so much hope for what life is going to be after you finish school, and uncertainty, and I just think it's a really interesting time to be 18 and still a teenager, but wanting that independence and finding it and struggling with it. And that's sort of where the voice is naturally fallen into someone of that age dealing with that experience.
Yeah, lovely. No, I really enjoy reading about that experience as well, because I think both books have, in quite a different way from Elise's experience, I suppose. I don't have this shared house experience, but I was an international student. So moving here at 18 was quite a big change. Even though Brooke's experience is not the same, there's all of that, you know, figuring out what uni is like, not wanting to be late and trying to make friends.
And the idea of the sort of friendships transitioning to, I appreciated, you know, how her high school friends maybe are just not, you know, kind of going into the next period of her life and finding her, it's probably not quite found family, but just, you know, finding the next group of friends who might be in the similar life stage, I think was really nice to see.
Yes, finding where you fit in and who you fit in with and how are you bringing any friendships along or are you not? And all of that is such a big challenging time when you start uni. And it's fun to explore.
Definitely.
Yeah. I do find it hilarious who she it does end up connecting with from high school, but I'll keep that for later.
Maybe for the spoiler question, we can touch on that. But I did want to talk as well a little bit about her relationship with Jesse. You know, we know it's a rom-com, so it's not a full spoiler to say who she, you know, what that trajectory is like. But before we go into sort of details about their relationship development through the book, I wanted to ask about Jesse's background. So, you know, his feelings about his place in his family is really quite heartbreaking to see, and an interesting contrast to Brooke, who is quite secure in her belonging at home, obviously with her own challenges with her family. But can you talk a little bit about Jesse's backstory and how you developed his character?
Yeah, I wanted him for him to feel like he is never belonging. That was sort of the core of what was going on with him. His background is that his parents had him, they got divorced, both got remarried, and both had kids with their new partners. And so he is left feeling like he's sort of the mistake child, the child that came out of the marriage that didn't work, and now they both have these happy other families, and he's just always moving between the two households, fitting in around everyone else, and never quite belonging. And so he's got this sense hanging over him that he doesn't belong, and he's looking for somewhere that he belongs. And that's kind of his journey in the book. There's an incident between Brooke and Jesse in high school, and that a lot of that is driven about from him having just come to the school and wanting to feel like he belongs there. And that's, yes, his journey and finding a place in the share house that he finally feels comfortable after having that feeling with his parents, and he feels like he can't communicate to them because they just fall into these old patterns of fighting. And yeah, that was the journey I wanted to explore with him, which I felt was an interesting story for him, and it made sense for his character, and I enjoyed kind of, it's not enjoyed is probably the wrong word, but it was what I wanted to explore with him and family and his dynamics and how they interacted with Brooke and her dynamics.
I really love his character, I suppose, because he's a lovely guy, but he comes from this heartbreaking background as well. I mean, not to put any pressure on you, but if you ever want to write a book about Jesse, I will be here to read it.
Pretty cool time.
I mean, that's kind of the challenge when you're writing, I guess. The book has the romantic trope of enemies to lovers, sort of. They've had this falling, Brooke and Jesse have had this falling out in high school, and they're now living together, and they are not friends. And so you have to, within that, you still need to make him a really lovable guy who is, that you want them to be together, and you want the reader to fall in love with him along with Brooke. So it's the balancing act of, he has betrayed her, he's not perfect, but he's still, you need to understand him and fall in love with him as the reader.
Yeah, enemies to lovers is Elise's favorite trope, whereas it doesn't always work for me. But in this case, when we find out about the incident, I was like, oh no. But then he watched Vampire Diaries with her, and I was like, being quite lovely about, you know, all of it, and like, it was, yeah, I got on board pretty quickly.
I don't love enemies to lovers as a blanket rule, okay? I just think when it's done well, it's one of the most satisfying tropes to have.
So. And enemies is a loose term when you say enemies to lovers. If you're talking about a fantasy book, it could mean like literal enemy that has killed your friend's enemy. Whereas in this context, it's someone who has betrayed you in high school. But, you know, that kind of wound can stay with you forever.
Well, it's quite formative for Brooke as well, and, absolutely, you know, feeding into her a lot of her anxieties and worries about how other people perceive her and whether she's capable of being loved and all of these, you know, nasty thoughts that go through our brains at times. So, yeah, such a formative experience for her. No wonder she held on to that resentment for many years to come.
Yes, and, you know, she's a grudge holder, so she held on to her grudge.
But I am glad that we got to see Jessie's perspective of it too, not to go into the spoilers too much as well, but I felt that, you know, we could understand his actions without thinking it was okay.
That's where, as an author, I'm trying to get to of, and it is hard. It's hard to get that balance right. I actually rewrote that backstory between them a few times because it was so crucial to get it exactly right and hit the exact right emotional notes for them both. And even though it's just one sort of one chapter, one scene, if it wasn't right, the whole book kind of could fall apart. So, yeah.
Yeah. We think you did a great job. Because, I could really feel the hurt that Brooke was feeling. But I also, as you said, really understood where Jessie was coming from with all of that. Before we move on into the spoilers questions, do you have any author or book recommendations to share with our listeners?
In terms of YA books that I've read this year, I really love The Museum of Broken Things by Lauren Draper, which is a really beautiful, it's kind of your classic YA, which is set in a small town dealing with friendships and romance and grief, and there's a mystery, and it's just such a beautiful book. I also recently read, in terms of nonfiction, I read a book called Wild Things by Sally Rippon, which is about I think the subtitle is called How We Learn to Read and What Happens If We Don't. And it's about her journey with her son, his difficulties with reading and how that kind of in the early years of his schooling and the impact it had over his entire sort of schooling life and what reading, learning to read and everything about reading and how we learn to read, and it's not always as easy as we think. And it was just a fascinating book, and Sally is a brilliant children's book author who, yeah, has written this fascinating sort of nonfiction / memoir.
Wonderful.
Yeah.
Thank you for the recommendations. I know Lauren Draper's book has been on my radar as well for a little while, so that's just adding to the rationale to read that one soon, I think.
It's such a beautiful book.
Excellent. Well, look, in that case, we might transition to some of our more spoilery questions. So I guess just for our listeners, just keep in mind that if you haven't read the book, now might be the time to tune out and come back once you have read the book, as we'll be going into some of the stuff that happens in the latter third or so of the read.
So you've got an idea for a business, the store of your dreams. There's just one thing to figure out. Everything. That's why Shopify's all-in-one commerce platform makes it easy to sell online, in person, and everywhere else. Sell on social media, source products with an app to get that first sale feeling. It's the only solution that gives you everything you need to sell everywhere you want. So when you're ready to bring your idea to life, power it up with Shopify.
Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/listen.
Spin your passion into a business with Shopify and break sales records with the world's best converting checkout. Let's hear that one more time. The world's best converting checkout. Shopify's legendary checkout makes it easier for customers to shop on your website, across social media, and everywhere in between. Now that's music to your ears. Any way you spin it, you can be a smash hit with Shopify. Start your dollar a month trial today at shopify.com/records.
The first question I have in terms of spoilers is a bit more about Brooke and Jessie. So, look, we felt that they were very compatible and really enjoyed their arc as the story went on. I'm wondering about how you approached their relationship arc, if you can shed some light into their, you know, trajectory as their relationship develops over the book, Vampire Diaries and all.
I say it's enemies to lovers, but it's actually friends to enemies to friends to lovers, and that's the kind of journey that they go on. So they have this instant friendship connection in high school, and then that all falls apart. Then they don't talk, but they both sort of think of each other still. She's holding onto this grudge, still very hurt. And then I wanted to build, I had to, you know, build them reconnecting. And Brooke did never wanted to be vulnerable in front of him. So, of course, I have to make her continually be vulnerable. So they have the bonding incident is when he helps her when she has the burst ovarian cyst while she's out running, and he's there and he takes her to the emergency room, and that's when they bond.
Was it cis-situation?
So that was sort of the... That was the big turning point in their relationship, and I knew I needed something fairly large, like a situation where Brooke is vulnerable and doesn't want to be, and he helps her out in a way that really resonates with her. And from there, they build into a friendship where they're spending time together, and he's watching The Vampire Diaries with her. And that's just because I personally, you know, watching TV shows together is a big part of what my partner and I did when we were sort of early in our relationship. And it's just a very, I think, enjoyable couple bonding experience. So, yes, they bond, and then you have the fun trope of fake dating that I just sort of when Jesse steps in and pretends to be her boyfriend when Tristan, her ex, comes into the story. And, you know, I do love the fake dating trope, and it just, I was never planning on having it in the book, but suddenly it all kind of fit together because I knew I wanted them to kiss without them being together. And of course you need to come up with a kind of convoluted reason for that to happen. But I needed it to recreate what happened in high school, and then for all, like, I needed Brooke to face her worst fear, which is that happening again. And that's sort of what that whole scene is about, as well as lovely romantic tension. It's about, you know, Brooke having to relive the moment again and feeling like he's betrayed me again.
Mm. Mm. Bringing back all of those feelings once more.
Her worst fear. Yeah. And after all this, she can't trust him, and all of her trust issues and everything sort of that has created that, and she can't trust her, you know, it's all come from she's never trusted her dad, and so it's all there, brought to the surface, and she's left feeling very unhinged about the whole thing. And then I throw in her sister who brings chaos, because in that third act I needed some chaos to be brought in, something to blow open the story. And so Lauren comes in, and that sort of brings everything to a head. And the journey is really, yeah, about Brooke. Can she trust Jesse? Can she trust her feelings, his feelings for her? All of the worst case scenarios that she sort of approaches everything in life thinking about, like, this is all going to go wrong, and his kind of gentle bringing her back around on things and accepting who she is, and just trying to build a really lovely relationship there between them.
Mm. It's lovely that he is a calming presence, but you've avoided that horrible trope of, you know, love will cure you kind of thing. Yeah. Like, yeah. She's still who she is, maybe a little bit, you know, she breathes a little bit more, but she's still, you know, she still likes to organize, and she still has the catastrophizing tendencies. He's just kind of there to anchor her a little bit sometimes.
That's exactly right. Yes. He's there to anchor her is the perfect way of putting it.
Yeah. One thing I really dislike is this idea of, you know, you can't be with someone else until you're whole yourself, until you're, you know, fixed or perfect or cured or anything along those lines. So it was, yeah, I just found it really nice to see that he still loved her for who she was.
That's right. That's exactly right. And she grew, like, there was character growth, but as you said, that wasn't the journey that she was on, which is like a magic solution and changing her personality entirely. And it was about her, more about her getting to the point where she can be loved and accept love for who she is.
Yeah. Now, this is a silly question probably, but I'm so curious. That Vampire Diaries episode guide, is that really how you watch it?
Yes. I'm glad you're curious. Yes, that is my actual guide. If someone was like, how should I watch the Vampire Diaries? Yeah. That would be the guide I would give them, which is start at the beginning, but the first season takes a while to warm up. And then, yeah, there's only certain episodes I'd be watching from the later seasons. That is my guide.
Okay. Because I used to watch the Vampire Diaries, but I was Team Stefan. And then as soon as it turned into Team Damon, I was like, oh, do I really want to continue? But I might try that episode guide.
I'll have to email you the exact episodes to watch from each season, but I'll adapt them for a Team Stefan person.
I mean, thank you. That would be great.
Having never watched the Vampire Diaries, I cannot comment, but I will say that as someone who loves Buffy the Vampire Slayer, I have pretty much the same thing in mind when I try to get people to watch Buffy the Vampire Slayer in terms of what to watch, what to skip, and what to watch with a grain of salt.
And that's really, I was going to put a fake TV show in there, and then I thought, no, I'm just going to throw in one that I've watched and watched with other people, or tried to get other people to watch and have that experience of like, no, just push through the first 10 episodes, maybe 15.
I feel like there's so many shows like that where people just say, oh, you've just got to like push through the first 7 seasons and then season 8 is amazing. I'm like, I don't think I want to watch 7 seasons before I get to that.
Yes, that's exactly right.
Going back to what we were discussing before about how, you know, Brooke has growth in the story, but, you know, not completely change. We both really like the fact that she stuck to her decision to not drink throughout the story. Yes. Can you talk a bit more about that?
Yes, it was never, that is a bugbear of mine of stories of like, they start out not drinking and then they have a drink and I don't know. That was not the journey that she was on. That is a big challenge when you're young and you don't drink. And especially coming from, it depends on the environment that you're in, coming from a small town where the drinking culture might be quite extensive, that question, even before, you know, when you're young and in high school, there always needs to be an answer to the question of why don't you drink? And even more so once you're 18 and you're out in the world. And so that was always going to be a challenge for Brooke. And I wanted to make, this was not a story about her learning to go out and get drunk. That was just a part of who she was, and it was all tied up, obviously, in the story of her dad and his drinking and her sister and her drinking, and all of that kind of makes Brooke who she is and is all part of her sort of her anxiety and her control issues and her desire to never feel out of control. But also just to be like, it's actually, you know, there are a lot of young people who don't drink and that's completely fine and normal. So I wanted to make that a part of who she was and a part that wasn't changing.
Yeah, I love that. And I think I read somewhere that the number of young people choosing to be sober is actually rising, or at
that's
least
true.
Yeah, drinking's going down. Yeah.
Yes, I think so, especially over the COVID years as well, where it's harder to even get out and socialize. But like when I was 18, everyone drank, whereas now I think it is much more, much less. But again, I think it does depend on where you are, your social scene and all of that.
100%. And we know that there's issues like vaping, for example, which wasn't a thing when I was 18. It really depends on, I guess, what generation and, you know, where you are and all of these interacting factors that might go on. And I guess, you know, we also, as we touched on before, we did appreciate that Brooke's anxiety didn't completely disappear by the end of the book. I feel like it would have been pretty disingenuous if it had. But it definitely, it feels like it's lessened in intensity by the end. She's more comfortable sitting with uncertainty, being more present. How would you personally describe Brooke's inner world by the book's ending?
Definitely less anxious. And that's because she feels more comfortable in the house she's in, like moving into a new house, starting university, all of that were like peak sort of triggers for her anxiety, and that's all happening at the beginning. And by the end of the book, she's found friendships. She's comfortable in the house. She has the relationship with Jesse. All of these things, yeah, are grounding her, easing off some of that uncertainty and that fear that she has when everything's new and fresh and she's trying to figure it out. So definitely her anxiety is lessened, but she's still an extremely anxious person. She still has a lot to work through with her family issues and everything that's going on. But that's a long time journey that wasn't going to be covered in this story. And that's not what I was trying to, you know, it was, as I say, it's a rom-com. So her mental health is very much part of it, but it was not a journey from like, yeah, she's anxious and now that's magically all solved.
And I think we're both glad about that as well.
Yeah. Yeah.
Because that's a trope that I personally really find frustrating as someone who has lived experience of pretty significant anxiety and has also been in some long-term, very healthy relationships and magically does not go away just because of that.
No. Exactly. You don't have to solve it before you have the relationship, but the relationship won't solve it either. And those are the sort of the two.
Yes. Things. It can help, but it's not some kind of cure for it.
Yeah. I feel like we should talk about Lauren. And maybe it's because I'm one of two sisters. I find what you said before was really interesting, that it's so common for the eldest daughter or the eldest child to be that I was going to say controlling, but that's not the best word, to be the one who's like organized and, you know, the mom friend, I suppose, and all that. It's very interesting to see that flip and to have that scene at the end where Lauren was saying, well, actually, I've been looking after you too. You just never saw it. So I thought that was really lovely. So would you like to talk more about that relationship?
Yeah, I wanted... Originally, well, my first idea of the book was going to be all about the sisters, and then I changed it. It's in Melbourne, and it's about uni, and there's no sister, but Lauren kept coming back, and I couldn't sort of, and I wasn't even. She was just going to be a small sort of. She was never going to appear, but then she came bursting through in that final act, and so she kind of. Worked her way in as a character, and which I'm so glad, because I think she's a really interesting character to write, because you are just seeing her through Brooke's eyes all of the time, and it's not the most flattering viewpoint. Well, Brooke obviously loves her, but and then when you do get that moment where they talk, and Lauren points out that she has looked after Brooke, and yeah, I thought that was a really important sort of dynamic to show there are different ways of caring for each other. There are different ways of protecting each other, and everyone's going to do it in their own way. And you can't control someone. And that this is kind of going to be something that's with Brooke for the rest of her life, that desire to protect Lauren, and Lauren is a risk taker and Brooke is not. And I think, something that a lot of people – do experience with their siblings, you want to protect them, but you can't control them when you're adults. And it's a little bit drawn from, well, I am the younger sister. I have an older sister. My older sister is not Lauren. I shouldn't. Although when I wrote my first book, my sister read it and was like, well, where am I?
All right.
Make sure I'm in the next one. I was like, okay, the next one's all going to be about sister. there is a little bit of the dynamic in that she was always sort of, I wouldn't say I was certainly never her protector, but we did have a different dynamic to that traditional, you know, the older type A protector. That was not our dynamic. And so I guess that's a little bit what I explored here, again, emphasizing that she is not the character of Lauren, but that sisterly relationship, that where you know each other so well and you know each other's, you can easily poke and prod each other and fight, and then it's fine. And you have that intimacy that you may never have with anyone else, because you've grown, you're not going to have a shared childhood with anyone else.
Yeah, absolutely. And what you mentioned there about, you know, wanting to protect your sister, but trying to recognize a boundary, I suppose, about where their choices are their own, and there's not so much you can do about that. I think I can relate to that as well. I seem to go on tangents a lot, but I should also say that karaoke scene, it's like, meltdown is not the word for it, but the kind of outburst that I have fantasized about before. It's just like in those moments when you're really angry at someone, you just want to like make a scene and storm off.
I'm going to make a scene, yes. Yeah. And in Brooke's head, she like thinks she looks fantastic storming off, but then of course, if you're the person watching them, you're just probably embarrassed for them.
Yeah, and the whole aftermath of her going, oh, my jacket's still in there.
Yes.
Okay. If I did that, that would be what happened exactly.
Yes.
I'd probably leave my keys behind or something, just not be able to go home. And
yeah.
It's never quite as glamorous as it might seem to have that kind of outburst, is it? No.
It's just so satisfying though when she did it. It was like, oh, this is not pretty, but it's such a release. Yeah.
Yes. And I needed to have that moment where Brooke was out of control. And like, again, sort of that's her fear of just like making a scene and being out of control and everything flooding out of her and not her not having, you know, her structure in place. And then,
yeah.
And it was fine. And she got through it.
Yeah, she did. It was so, yeah, it was really good.
It definitely demonstrates that we all have these, you know, moments that might be embarrassing but are probably quite cathartic and yes. Have their benefits even if they don't go according to plan.
And if you bottle everything inside for too long, it will find a way out.
Yeah. 100%. And I wanted to ask as well, did you ever consider depicting Brooke start sort of actively addressing her anxiety within the timeline of the book? So, for example, going to a counsellor or a psychologist or doing self-help things, because obviously she is trying to address her insomnia at various mm-hmm. points in the story. Mm-hmm. But I was wondering if that was something that came across your mind with anxiety more broadly too.
I did have a counsellor in mind at one point, but it didn't fit with the story and it didn't fit with where she was at. So I didn't, but certainly she is someone who I see sort of having really good, helpful, healthy therapy in the future as she goes into her 20s. I also think, you know, when you're 18 and you're moving out and it's hard to recognize what your issues are. And, you know, it takes a long time to get that self-awareness to go, what, is this just me or is this something I can get help with or is everyone like this or is everyone not? And to learn, because I think you can be quite insular through high school in terms of your very sort of inward thinking and but not so self-aware of like maybe I have like maybe these are my issues. It takes a while to know what your issues are, I think, and then to get the appropriate help. So it felt like she was not there yet.
Yeah, and that's perfectly fine. You know, we don't ask that question to say that,
yeah,
this is what should be happening. But I guess, yeah, it's just something I get curious about as well when it comes to how when writers are talking about mental health content is, you know, at what point do you want a character to have that scene? Is it appropriate to have that scene or is that not what the story is about? And I think in this case it's more about her coming to that kind of point where things are different for her. Maybe, you know, there are some long-term challenges ahead, but we see that growth within the story, which, you know, is nice to see.
Especially when you're writing for teenagers, you do have to be really careful about how you're portraying mental health and, yeah, what they are, what solutions they're seeking and where the character ends up. So, yeah, getting the balance right is important.
That reminds me of, not directly related against tangents is my thing tonight, but Tristan, it made me laugh that he's the son of psychologists. Yes.
God, what are our kids going to be like today? I don't
know. Like, he's not a bad character. No,
like, I loved Tristan and found him endearing, while also, you know, he was there to be some comedic relief as
yes.
well.
Yeah. The poem.
Yes.
The cringe.
Yes. But I wanted him to sort of, he is like her ex and comedic relief, but also like they were well suited as friends. And like there were parts of, I wanted to kind of show like people can come back into your life and they can be someone else to you. And actually maybe you work better that way. And yeah, so I don't like to have out and out villains in my books. So that's what I try not to do.
Well, very few people are fully villains in real life as well. Yeah. Get more suited to maybe fantasy and so yes. on. Not so much in, you know, contemporary YA, in my opinion.
Yeah, I love the comments about how, you know, Tristan was drinking red wine at a certain age, trying to be sophisticated and probably really tries to be emotionally aware as well with all the things he did yes. for Brooke, but just didn't quite come across well, I suppose.
That's exactly right.
Yeah.
All right. Well, look, Nina, I think that might be the end of our questions for tonight.
Thank you so much.
Thank you. It's been such a joy to have you on the show. And, you know, I always, always appreciate it when we can sit down with an author and just talk about spoilers yes. as well, because how often do we get to do that?
Yes. This has been such a fun interview. Thank you.
We're glad you enjoyed it as well. But I will make a confession. We were at Leanne Hall's release of The Gaps.
Yeah.
And I was like, that's Nina Kenwood. I should go say hi. I should say how much I love the book. And I was like creeping from across the room. And I was like, no, I don't know. Like, I don't know how to come across not weird about this. So I'm glad I got to say it tonight.
Oh, thank you. And that is hilarious. And also absolutely would not have been weird.
Okay.
I would have
loved
it. But okay, next time. I'm so glad we got to talk. And this has been such a fun interview.
And that wraps up our interview. So on our website, some of the resources that we will link to include resources around recognizing and coping with anxiety, Nina's website and social media accounts, and the two books that she recommends.
And of course, a huge thank you to Nina Kenwood for donating her time to us. We really appreciated the interview and yeah, found it really insightful and fun, to be honest. It was just nice to have a chat with her about some of this stuff.
Yeah, that was my fangirl coming out.
I love it. Anyway, that wraps us up for today. So please remember to subscribe and follow to keep up to date with us and to know when our new episodes are posted. Hashtag season 3 is coming. Mm-hmm. Hashtag, or is it? I don't know. It's coming. Something's happening. Yeah. Something's happening. Just a reminder, of course, our website is novelfeelings.com. Please leave us a review on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. And you're also welcome to follow us on social media.
You're also welcome to follow me on Instagram at Paved with Books with an extra S. I don't know the state of my Instagram at the moment. It's been alive. I just need to update it for consistency.
Hey, it's still alive as far as I'm concerned. There's still stuff happening over at Paved with Books.
Thank you.
Thank you so much for listening, everybody. Stay tuned. There's exciting stuff in the works.
We hope to see you soon.
All right. Bye, everyone.
Bye.